So, welcome to Life Dung. I am Abigail Morris, producer, and in the studio we have Dr. Mark Borelowitz and Rabbi Miriam Berger.
Good morning.
And we are doing something that's both a mystery and very, very ordinary this month. We're talking about sleep, which can be seen as negative. We talk about night terrors and disturbed things, and very, very positive, a gift to be enjoyed. So, this month we're going to talk about the spiritual, the psychological, and the neurological aspects of sleep. So, Miriam, why particularly did you want to talk about sleep this month?
So I think sleep is a great example of what Wellspring offers, because we can all agree that sleep is inextricably linked with our well-being. We know how difficult it is to function in life when we're not getting a good night's sleep, and how much our mood and what we're going through and experiencing in life affects our sleep, and kind of vice versa. But also, it's one of those fascinating well-being topics that Judaism has a lot to say about as well. And probably not surprisingly, because we've always had to do it, and therefore it's always been something that we've talked about. So why would the rabbis not have a view on it as well? And so in the middle of June, we've got a wonderful in-person session with sleep consultant Marianne Taylor. And Marianne and I are going to do a little bit of work on looking at some of our liturgy and some really practical tips on how to get a good night's sleep. Really a follow-on from a session I did a few weeks ago on the morning blessings. But it's one of those great examples of what ultimately Wellspring will offer, which is that real connection between our well-being and our Jewish teachings.
So let's go dive into some of those Jewish teachings about sleep then.
Well, I guess the best place to start are the words of Moshe Makiri, who was writing in the 16th century in Sfat. And he talks about sleep being 1/60th of death. Now, even in itself, that 60th of death is a great number, and we can definitely kind of come back to, well, what does that mean? But because sleep is a 60th of death, he tells us that before one departs this world, as in before one goes to sleep, it's fitting to accept the yoke of heaven, i.e. one has to say the Shema, and to accept that we love God, via hafta. Now, that's also the words that you say on your deathbed. So it's as if what Makiri is saying is every night are your final words, your deathbed confession, as you fall asleep. For the, you know, our ancient wisdom was very much rolled up in if sleep and death are interconnected, we basically have to treat every night as if it's our last.
So, Mark, do you want to fill us in on some of the neurological aspects of sleep? What happens when we don't sleep?
Well, what happens when we don't sleep is that we put ourselves at risk for the things that drinking too much and being overweight and being stressed also put us at risk for: depression, anxiety, inflammatory diseases, and some articles say slightly higher risk of Alzheimer's disease. I mean, all that stuff is the last thing you want to be thinking about at 1 o'clock in the morning. You're definitely not going to go to sleep. So this is knowledge that we have to try and make use of at another time of the day if we wish to bring it to bear. The patients I see, I think, would be terrified by Makiri's illuminations. If you've got separation anxiety, you worry that everyone you care about might die when you go to sleep, and that keeps you awake at night, because if you're not thinking about them, they might die. I mean, that's characteristic of separation anxiety. So the metaphor is fantastic, and it fits in with Hamlet's sense of what his afterlife might be like, full of terrible dreams about his misdeeds. But for people who come to see psychiatrists and psychologists, it's a very, very complicated matter. And some people fear sleep because of separation anxiety and worries about death. Other people fear sleep because they're going to dream about the trauma again and again and again. And it's really a reliving of it. At the time, it obviously doesn't feel like a dream. It feels hyper-real. A few people I've seen have taught me about something else, a much happier kind of dream in which they never suffered the trauma. They have both legs. They can run. They don't have cancer. And then when they wake up, they feel sad. because the dream is over, as the expression goes, and reality bites. Now, I can see how we should try to fit religion into that, because in the morning we have to wake up and try to be grateful for the day that's ahead of us. But it's pretty challenging if being asleep was preferable, and it's super challenging if you can't sleep because you're terrified by sleep.
So how does Judaism help us then in the morning?
Well, Judaism gives us this great way into each day, because essentially, if you've gone to bed on your deathbed confession and gone to bed with a real reality, a real sense of this might be it, and, you know, what it really shows is Judaism was way ahead of its time with, you know, we take quotes like don't go to bed on an argument and think that that's kind of some sort of more modern idea, but actually, you don't go to bed on an argument because you're anxious that you might never get to resolve that argument. Therefore, Judaism paints this picture of you essentially wake up with every day being akin to a resurrection, or at least a gift of a day you couldn't have taken for granted. And so it gives us this very slow stepping into the world, our first expression of the day of Moda Ani, and then really a list of blessings, which, you know, I think have been ruined by being put in the Siddur. They are really kind of gritty realities of life. You know, the blessing for going to the toilet, and that acknowledgement that, okay, I know my body's kind of working because I've done a poo this morning, a blessing for my eyes being open to the day, a blessing for dressing, for clothing the naked. Each of these blessings is really just an expression of the very mundane realities that we take for granted. Actually, if they're accompanied by a blessing, how can you take them for granted?
So you talked about ritual and the psychological aspects of the ritual. Do you want to talk? Can you kind of flesh out a little bit for us?
Yes, of course. But I think that the ritual that we read about in the newspapers, which is called sleep hygiene, is in fact insufficient. And what Miriam's been talking about and how you bring the ideas of religion into it is much more important, because every newspaper has cut and paste articles every week about sleep hygiene. Don't drink too much alcohol, put your phone away at 10 o'clock at night, don't go to the gym at 11 o'clock, don't have an argument, have a dark room, all that kind of stuff. The really valuable stuff about sleep starts with your day, your week, your month, your year, how you conduct yourself overall in such a way as to make sleep more likely. If you're just waiting to kick it in at 9 p.m., you've left it too late, frankly, most of the time. So it's about trying to be as physically well as one can be, but also having a sense of fulfillment and a reasonable day. And if we possibly can, a life well lived as well. And if I can give a sort of out of left field example from the psychiatrist's office, people with ADHD struggle to sleep. And the medication for ADHD is a stimulant. So it also makes it harder to sleep. But I have young patients who say, no, I actually sleep better on the medication, not worse. And I say, tell me more. Well, I didn't get into trouble at school. I did all my work. I didn't spend any time worrying about where I'd lost things and how to find them. I had a good day, and I went to sleep. I know it sounds weird, doctor, but I sleep better on this medication, not worse. So, you know, that's another way of looking at having a day that works compared to a day that doesn't work.
Yeah.
And I think religion helps us think about that.
Yeah, that as we start off our day, we bring in that sense of gratitude. And what's interesting is I think the journey between the evening and bedtime. So part of our evening liturgy, for instance, is Hashkivenu, a real kind of prayer that acknowledges all of the vulnerabilities in life and all of the anxieties that people might carry with us. But there's a break between that kind of that liturgy around Maariv and that evening kind of process of acknowledging that it's getting dark and the sort of acceptance and perhaps a little bit of that sukkah shalom, that shelter of peace, but almost the kind of warm embrace, the ability to be able to surrender oneself to a higher being that says, all right, this deathbed confession moment doesn't need to be terrifying. The darkness is terrifying. What might happen to me in this world is terrifying. But if I surrender myself completely in this moment of sleep, then actually I've got nothing to fear because I'm kind of in the hands of God. And I quite like that ability to be able to say, actually, you know, who I'm not someone that likes to be cuddled at night, I have to say. I need my own space when I'm sleeping. But if you think of that kind of metaphorical hug as you go to sleep, that sense of being able to be embraced into that easing yourself into your subconscious, that's a nice.
So that's a really interesting idea, the separation between the fear of the dark and the fear of the sleep. And I think it's Adam is very scared when it first gets dark. Do you want to just tell us what
right,
happens to Adam on the
first? There's lots of Midrashim based in the Garden of Eden narrative, where we've got Adam sort of embracing his new life in the garden and everything's perfect until it reaches dusk, and what he sees is this looming darkness and assumes it's him that is the first, or the Midrashim around Adam, that's this first association with darkness being the end of time and the end of life, that he sees the end of the first day as being the potential for this being it. And so that sense of darkness marking the end of something and marking something to fear is very much baked into all sorts of our Jewish narratives and text. But this sense of death is not necessarily something to fear, but rather, you know, if, as Mark says, if you've lived a good life, you've got nothing to fear because you're just going home to your maker, as it were.
I think that's really fascinating, the difference between fear of the dark and fear of the sleep. Did you see that in your patients or in psychological studies?
It's the very young children who seem to fear the dark, and young children who need night lights. But people with PTSD might need night lights, actually. But also, I think it's in our biology to fear the dark. That's when the leopards are out and about, but also the human predators, and life is less safe, and there are more road traffic accidents, and more stuff goes wrong in hospitals, and, you know, all kinds of things go wrong in the dark. And so we're right to be fearful and nervous of the dark. The darkness triggers feeling of lack of safety. Someone with post-traumatic stress disorder, someone who knows the bombs and the shelling come at night, someone who knows they can find their way to the shelter in the daytime but not at night, then sleep absolutely lacks the kind of comfort that Miriam was talking about. That, you know, it comes tinged with doubt about our bodies and minds are telling us it's actually wise and safe to go to sleep. And if someone's in that state, and I guess a lot of people in the world are, sleep becomes very fragile, and then the days become fragile, and that person's overall health is undermined. So this is a very, very serious matter, and I think not one to be dealt with by newspaper articles about sleep hygiene. That's only for the privileged, frankly.
Right. And in terms of our bodies needing sleep, we do have a natural circadian rhythm built in, don't we? Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
We seem to, a 24-hour clock. There was an experiment where some people lived in a Belgian or French cave for a month, and the scientists said their clock switched to a 26-hour clock, but I'm not sure that's been sustained over time, and the argument is our circadian rhythm is 24 hours. But it changes with the seasons. So we, in Scandi countries, people sleep less when it's light and longer when it's dark. Speaking personally, I wake up at 5:25. It happens so much like clockwork that I briefly wondered whether somebody was making a noise outside my house. I wake up at 5:25. But I can't live my life like that, because if I was completely ruled by that, then I need to go to sleep at 9:25. So imagine if we get a dinner invitation. Oh, thanks very much.
But we'll be there at 6.
We'll be there at 6, and the last wine has to be served at 7, and we need to leave at 8:30, you know. I wouldn't have been able to enjoy my children's weddings. I would have been tucked up in bed. So I think we have to be aware of our natural sleep cycles, but we can't be enslaved by them, because otherwise we won't be able to... I need to go to bed quite early. I mustn't turn it into a kind of a thing.
But I wonder what we do miss out on also by not being so regulated by the seasons, that actually our body's definitely telling us in the winter that we need to go to bed earlier, and in the summer that we can go to bed later and wake up earlier. There's nothing more miserable than waking up when it's still the middle of the night and you open the curtains to pitch black. And it's interesting, right? You know, we as within the reform movement, or as I should probably say now, the progressive world, you know, we bring in Shabbat, you know, the same time all year round, which to me makes sense, because we eat dinner the same sort of time all year round, and we go to bed at the same kind of time all year round. But there is a sense that actually our days do start at different times at different times of the year. And Shabbat that starts as it gets dark, there is something significant and beautiful about acknowledging that difference in time throughout the year. But it's a hard one to interweave with the modern world around us, particularly in a part of the world where that change of time is so extreme, whereas in other parts of the world, less so.
Yeah, and when your body clock is telling you something else, or when your gastroenterologist says you can't go to sleep on a full stomach, you're going to put yourself at risk of cancer of the esophagus or something like that because of your heartburn. And so my mum lives in a care home in Hendon, and she comes to us at the same time every Friday night for dinner. And her observations through the seasons are very interesting, because when I'm driving her home after we finished eating at 8 p.m. in the summer, and she sees people walking home from the synagogue, she says to me, "Mark, they're going to be having dinner very late." And she's absolutely right. And they are... the religion is requiring them to override something else. I mean, it's celebrated. I don't know if it's a problem for anybody, but it is an interesting kind of adaptation.
Going into that, so into Wellspring and what you think the sessions with Marianne will achieve, can you talk about what your hopes are for that, both Jewishly and psychologically, if that makes sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I think what Marianne can offer, which is different to the kind of articles that Mark was referring to, and that sort of the general sleep hygiene sort of tropes, is really being able to look at how our modern lives and ourselves as individuals can take responsibility to some extent for framing our day in a way that enables us to be able to sleep our best, rather than just being told the kind of like rules. This is not, you know, she's not going to sit there and lecture us about, you know, putting our phone away an hour before and you know, making sure it's a dark room. And I think that her kind of way of teaching about sleep is very much in tune with that Jewish concept of looking at the rhythm of the day, looking at some of the things that our Judaism gifts us about taking time throughout the day for ourselves, about acknowledging what's going on in the wider world and in our heads, and giving space to our thoughts at different times in the day, and that enabling ultimately a better night's sleep. You know, I think her real sense is the problem is when you think sleep starts at 10 o'clock at night, and being able to really reevaluate that.
Well, that's a lovely way to end, because yeah, that's exactly what you were saying right at the top of the show, Mark. Do you want to add to that?
Well, I think, Miriam, I think I've heard in what you're saying also something about reminding ourselves that we're not that important. The world will carry on spinning. We can go to sleep, and we should go to sleep. And I tell you the story because twice I've gone against my own advice. When I went to the toilet in the middle of the night, twice in the last eight, there have been two occasions in the last 8 years where I picked up my phone because I had to know the Brexit vote, and I had to know whether or not Clinton or Trump won. I didn't sleep a wink after finding out that information. And what difference would it have made if I'd waited till 8 a.m.? For me, no.
Or 5:25.
Yeah, 5:25, absolutely.
So any lasting tips for a good night's sleep before we pass? Leading a good life, what would you say?
Well, I'm happy to leave people with a... So we started by saying that the rabbis talked about sleep being a 60th of death, but that number is used in two other occasions. One about kashrut, which is if you drip, you know, a 60th of milk into a meaty pot. So if you spilt something into your chicken soup, if it's less than a 60th and wasn't intentional, you can get away with it, it's still kosher. But the thing I always wonder, they also say that that dreams are a 60th of prophecy. So what is that element of our dreams that we really should be looking at in a prophetic way and wondering what they tell us about our future?
Well, on that, I'll leave you to examine your dreams and have a very good month. Thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you,
Miriam.